Dr. John Clark's interest in archaeology began at the age of 6, when his oldest brother helped him hunt for arrowheads around their home in Burley, Idaho. By the 8th grade, his interest in artifacts surpassed his interest in dinosaurs, and he decided to become an archaeologist. In high school, he taught himself how to chip arrowheads and has studied and taught ancient technology since that time. While completing his baccalaureate and master's degrees in anthropology at BYU in the 1970s, he became excited about Mesoamerica mythology and archaeology, especially Mayan writing and calendar systems. With his wife and their 7-month-old son, he took an opportunity in 1977 to work for the church's New World Archaeological Foundation in Chiapas, Mexico. 4 years and 2 daughters later, the family moved to Ann Arbor, Michigan to pursue further studies. His dissertation research at the University of Michigan dealt with the origins of social privilege and the evolution of stratified or civilized societies in Mesoamerica. This remains his interest and research focus. Professor Clark worked for the New World Archaeological Foundation through graduate school and became its director in 1988, a position he still holds. He has done field work in southern Mexico or Guatemala for the past 27 years, principally on the earliest village societies and cities. He joined the anthropology department at BYU in 1990, and since 1999 has also served with BYU's Institute for the Study and Preservation of Ancient Religious Texts, or ISPART. The Clarks are parents of 4 sons and 2 daughters. We are now pleased to turn the time to Dr. John Clark.
The wee hours of September 22, 1827, found Joseph Smith climbing the western slope of a prominent hill near his home to keep his annual appointment with the angel Moroni. 4 years of probation the wiser, the 21-year-old prophet was finally entrusted with the golden plates and the sacred stones needed to translate them. The consequences of this event have been earth-shaking. The Book of Mormon, translated from this ancient record, is now available in another 104 languages, and over 120 million copies have been printed. The Book of Mormon challenges the world to take it seriously as an account of God's dealings with ancient New World peoples. Nothing less than salvation is at stake. The world has not taken this challenge lying down. It pushes back by denying the book's miraculous delivery and authenticity. While billions of people, in fact, remain indifferent to the book as they do to the Bible, a vociferous cadre of apostates and other critics clamor that the Book of Mormon is a fabrication, an ignorable fiction, but one they can't seem to leave alone. Since 1829, critics have attempted to discredit the Book of Mormon by claiming that it was written by Joseph Smith, not translated, and that its history has no grounding in the real world. They believe they are winning the day, but 175 years of falsehoods and weak arguments have not scratched the book's credibility. Because of what is at stake, let us agree that charges against the book are serious and require a response. The critical question concerns Book of Mormon authorship. Did Joseph Smith, Jr. write the book, or was it revealed through divine means? This is where archaeology steps in as the only scientific means of gathering evidence of authenticity and hence authorship. The Book of Mormon is unique in world scripture because its claimed divine origins can be evaluated by checking for concrete evidence in the real world. Prove the existence of Zarahemla, for example, and the validity of the rest follows. The logic is simple and compelling for both sides. Take the anti-Mormon position first. If Joseph Smith made the book up, then its peoples did not exist, its events did not happen, and there should be no trace of them anywhere. If, after a reasonable period of diligent searching, material evidence is not found, then the Book of Mormon would be shown to be imaginary, and by implication, Joseph Smith would be exposed as a liar and the Book of Mormon unveiled, the Mormon Church unveiled as a hoax. The LDS position is the near opposite. Confirmation of historic details of the Book of Mormon would substantiate Joseph Smith's account of how it came to be, and thus validate his seership and the divine origin of the book and of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. This brings us to the astonishing possibility of being able to test Joseph Smith's claims through science, a possibility critics have long tried to exploit. The Book of Mormon is the keystone of Mormonism. Destroy this stone and all that it supports will come crashing down. Given the stakes involved, the very possibility of testing the book's historicity and authenticity becomes a moral obligation to do so. Time precludes review of full LDS involvement with these issues. One example we'll have to do. Revisit with me Provost Academy Square the morning of April 17, 1900. The assembled student body of Brigham Young Academy is bidding farewell to their president and 15 fellow students as they ride off for South America. Academy President Benjamin Clough, Jr. hopes to discover the ancient Nephite capital of Zarahemla and in this way to establish the authenticity of the Book of Mormon. The expedition began with the blessings of the church, but not its financial backing, and even its blessing was withdrawn before the group ever left the United States. Of the original 24 men, 9 crossed into Mexico, and 6 made it to Colombia. After boating 630 miles up the Magdalena River, then 632 days from Academy Square, Colombian officials halted the anxious explorers' progress just days short of their destination. Clough and his students never reached Zarahemla. Mormon scholars and tourists have been trying to get there ever since, but it is not clear where they should look, how they should look, or how they will know Zarahemla when they find it. Clough returned to become the first president of Brigham Young University. His proposal for the location of Zarahemla was apparently a popular one among Mormons at the time. He presumed Book of Mormon lands included both North and South America, or what is known as the hemispheric model or traditional view. That it took nearly 2 years to meander to Colombia should have given him pause. The longest trip specified in the Book of Mormon took 40 days, and that group was lost. An argument against the hemisphere model was provided by Joseph Smith. 1842 in Nauvoo had been another hectic year as the prophet moved the work along on the Book of Abraham and the temple, all the while dodging false arrest. He even assumed editorial responsibility for the Times and Seasons. Months earlier, he received a copy of a recent bestseller by John Lloyd Stevens, Incidents of Travel in Central America, Chiapas, and Yucatan, the first English book to describe and illustrate Maya ruins. This book amazed the English-speaking world with evidence of an advanced civilization no one imagined existed, no one, that is, except Mormons. The prophet was thrilled, and excerpts from the book were reprinted in the Times and Seasons with unsigned commentary, presumably his. What Joseph recorded is significant for the issues at hand. Quote, "Since our extract was published, we have found another important fact relating to the truth of the Book of Mormon. Central America is situated north of the Isthmus of Darien and once embraced several hundred miles of territory from north to south. The city of Zarahemla stood upon this land. It will not be a bad plan to compare Mr. Stevens' ruined cities with those in the Book of Mormon," end quote. As evident in his comments, Joseph Smith believed Maya archaeology validated the Book of Mormon. His placement of Zarahemla in eastern Guatemala implied that the land southward described in the Book of Mormon was north of Darien, as Panama was then called. Thus, his commentary presupposed a smallish geography that excluded South America. The prophet regarded the location of Book of Mormon lands an open question, and one subject to archaeological confirmation. In the past 50 years, friends and foes have adopted Joseph's plan of comparing ruined cities with those in the Book of Mormon. Both sides believe archaeology is on their side. Consider the argument against the Book of Mormon circulated recently by an evangelical group. Quote, "The Bible is supported in its truth claims by the corroborating evidence of geography and archaeology. That assertion cannot be said for the Book of Mormon. Several decades of archaeological research funded by LDS institutions concentrating in Central America and Mexico have yielded nothing that corroborates the historic events described in the Book of Mormon," end quote. The only things wrong with this clever argument are that its claims are false and its logic faulty. Archaeology and geography support the Book of Mormon to the same degree and for the same reasons that they support the Bible. Both books present the same challenges for empirical confirmation, and both are in good shape. Many things have been verified for each, but many have not. Anti-Mormon arguments specialize in listing things mentioned in the Book of Mormon that archaeology has not found. Rather than cry over missing evidence, I will tell you about evidence that has been found. The pamphlet lists 8 deficiencies. First, that no Book of Mormon cities have been located. And last, that no artifact of any kind that demonstrates the Book of Mormon is true has been found. This last assertion is overly optimistic in suggesting that such material proof is even possible. No artifact imaginable, or even a roomful, could ever convince critics that the Book of Mormon is true. The implied claim that the right relic could prove the book's truth beyond all doubt is too strong and underestimates human cussedness. Moroni could appear before Congress tomorrow with the golden plates, the sword of Laban, and the Liahona in hand, and this would not satisfy public demands for more proofs. The logical challenges with the first assertion, that no cities have been located, are more subtle. Book of Mormon cities have been found, they are well known, and their artifacts grace the finest museums. They are merely masked by archaeological labels such as Maya, Olmec, and so on. The problem, then, is not that Book of Mormon artifacts have not been found, only that they have not been recognized for what they are. Again, if you stumbled onto Zarahemla, how would you know? One last point about significant evidence. The hypothesis of human authorship demands that truth claims in the Book of Mormon be judged by what was believed, known, or knowable in Joseph's backyard in the 1820s. The book's description of ancient peoples differs greatly from the notions of rude savages held by 19th century Americans. The book's claim of city societies was laughable at the time, but no one is laughing now. As a city example shows, the lower the probability that Joseph Smith could have guessed a future fact, the stronger the likelihood that he received the information from a divine source. Consequently, the most compelling evidence of authenticity is that which verifies unguessable things recorded in the Book of Mormon. The more outlandish, the better. Confirmation of such things would eliminate any residual probability of human authorship and go a long way in demonstrating that Joseph Smith could not have written the book. This is precisely what a century of archaeology has done. I will consider a few items in the time remaining. The one requirement for making comparisons between archaeology and the Book of Mormon is to be in the right place. For reasons I will explore in a few minutes, Mesoamerica is the right place. The first archaeological claims related to the Book of Mormon concern the facts of September 22, 1827, the actuality of metal plates preserved in a stone box. This used to be considered a monstrous tale, but concealing metal records in stone boxes is now a documented old world practice. Stone offering boxes have also been discovered in Mesoamerica, but so far the golden plates are still at large, as we would expect them to be. Another fact obvious that September morning was that ancient peoples of the Americas knew how to write, a ludicrous claim for anyone to make in 1827. We now know of at least 6 Mesoamerican writing systems that predate the Christian era. This should count for something, but it is not enough for dedicated skeptics. They demand to see Reformed Egyptian, preferably on gold pages, and to find traces of the Hebrew language. There are promising leads on both, but nothing conclusive yet. New scripts are still being discovered, and many texts remain undeciphered. The example shown here was recovered 56 years ago and qualifies as America's earliest writing sample. But so far, nothing much has been made of it, and most scholars have forgotten that it exists. The golden plates and other relics ended up in New York in the final instance because the Nephites were exterminated in a cataclysmic battle. The Book of Mormon brims with warfare and nasty people. Until 20 years ago, the book's claims on this matter were poo-pooed by the famous scholars. Now that Maya writing is being read, warfare appears to have been a Mesoamerican pastime. The information on warfare in the Book of Mormon is particularly rich and provides ample opportunity to check Joseph Smith's luck in getting the details right. The warfare described in the book differs from what Joseph could have known or imagined. In the book, one reads of fortified cities with ditches, walls, and palisades. Mesoamerican cities dating to Nephite times have been found with all these features. The Book of Mormon mentions bows and arrows, swords, slings, scimitars, clubs, spears, shields, breastplates, helmets, and cotton armor, all items documented for Mesoamerica. Aztec swords were of wood, sometimes edged with stone knives. There are indications of wooden swords in the Book of Mormon. How else could swords become stained with blood? Wooden swords could sever heads and limbs and were lethal. The practice of taking detached arms as battle trophies, as in the story of Ammon, is also documented for Mesoamerica. Another precise correspondence is the practice of fleeing to the summits of pyramids as places of last defense, and consequently, of eventual surrender. Conquered cities were depicted in Mesoamerica by symbols for broken towers or burning pyramids. Mormon records this practice. Other practices of his day were human sacrifice and cannibalism. Vile behaviors well attested for Mesoamerica. The final battle at Cumorah involved staggering numbers of troops and of Nephite battle units of 10,000. Aztec documents described armies of over 200,000 warriors, also divided into command units of 10,000. The Aztec ciphers appear to be propagandistic exaggeration. I do not know whether this applies to Book of Mormon numbers or not. In summary, the practices and instruments of war described in the Book of Mormon display multiple and precise correspondences with Mesoamerican practices, and in ways unimaginable to 19th century Americans. Mesoamerica is a land of decomposing cities, with their pyramids or towers, temples, and palaces, all items mentioned in the Book of Mormon, but foreign to the gossip along the Erie Canal in Joseph Smith's day. Cities show up in all the right places and for the predicted times. One of the more unusual and specific claims in the Book of Mormon is that houses and cities of cement were built by 49 BC in the land northward, a claim considered ridiculous in 1830. As it turns out, it receives remarkable confirmation at Tetehuacan, the largest pre-Columbian city ever built in the Americas. Tetehuacan is still covered with ancient cement that has lasted over 1,500 years. All Book of Mormon peoples had kings who ruled cities and territories. American prejudices of native tribes in Joseph's day had no room for kings or their tyrannies. These were crazy claims. The last Jaredite king, Coriantumr, carved his history on a stone about 300 BC, an event in line with Mesoamerican practices at that time. A particular gem in the book is that King Benjamin labored with his own hands, an outrageous thing for Joseph Smith to claim for a king. It was not until the 1960s that anthropology caught up to the idea of working kings and validated it among world cultures. Even more specific, considered Riplakish, the 10th Jaredite king, an oppressive tyrant who forced slaves to construct buildings and produce fancy goods. Among the items he commissioned about 1200 BC was an exceedingly beautiful throne. The earliest civilization in Mesoamerica is known for its elaborate stone thrones. How did Joseph Smith get this detail right? Not all evidence concerns material goods. A striking correspondence is this drawing from the Dresden Codex, one of four surviving pre-Columbian Maya books. It shows a sacrificial victim with a tree growing from his heart, a literal portrayal of the metaphor preached in Alma chapter 32. Other images depict the tree of life. The book's metaphors make sense in the Mesoamerican world. We are just beginning to study these metaphors, so check in with the Journal Book of Mormon Studies for future developments. A correspondence that has always impressed me involves prophecies in 400-year blocks. The Maya were obsessed with time, and they carved precise dates on their stone monuments that began with the count of 400 years, an interval called a baktun. Each baktun was made up of 20 katuns, an extremely important 20-year interval. If you will permit me some liberties with the text, Samuel the Lamanite warned the Nephites that one baktun shall not pass away before they would be smitten. Nephi and Alma uttered the same baktun prophecy, and Moroni recorded its fulfillment. Moroni bids us farewell just after the first katun of this final baktun, or 420 years since the sign was given of the coming of Christ. What are the chances of Joseph Smith guessing correctly the vigesimal system of timekeeping and prophesying among the Maya? The list of unusual items corresponding to Book of Mormon claims could be extended. The LDS tendency to get absorbed in specifics has been characterized as a method for distracting attention from large problems by engaging critics with endless irrelevant details, much as a mosquito swarm distracts from the rhinoceros in the kitchen. Let's take up the dare to consider big issues, namely geography and cycles of civilization and population. As is clear from the Clough expedition, if the geography is not right, one can waste years searching for Zarahemla and never get there. Book of Mormon geography presents a serious challenge because the only city location known with certitude is Old World Jerusalem, and this does not help us with locations in the Promised Land. However, it is marvelous for the Old World portion of the narrative. As Kent Brown and others have shown, the geography of the Arabian Peninsula described in 1 Nephi is precise down to its place names. The remarkable geographic fit includes numerous details unknown in Joseph Smith's day. For the New World, dealing with geography is a two-step exercise. An internal geography must first be deduced from clues in the book, and this deduction must then become the standard for identifying a real-world setting. John Sorensen has done the best work on this matter, and this is his internal map of physical features and cities. The Book of Mormon account is remarkably consistent throughout. Nephite lands included a narrow neck between two seas and lands northward and southward of this neck. The land southward could be traversed on foot with children and animals in tow in about 30 days, so it could not have been much longer than 300 miles. The 3,000 miles required for the traditional geography is off by one order of magnitude. Nephite lands were small and did not include all of the Americas or their peoples. The principal corollary of a limited geography is that Book of Mormon peoples were not alone on the continent. Therefore, to check for correspondences, we must find the right place and peoples. It is worth noticing that anti-Mormons lament the demise of traditional continental geography because it was so easy to ridicule. The limited geography is giving them fits. Sorensen argues that Book of Mormon lands and peoples were in Central America and Southern Mexico, an area known as Mesoamerica. This illustration shows how Sorensen's proposal compares to the hemispheric interpretation. Notice in this amplified view that the configuration of lands, seas, mountains, and other natural features in Mesoamerica are a tight fit with the internal requirements. It is important to stress that finding any sector in the Americas that fits Book of Mormon specifications requires dealing with hundreds of mutually dependent variables. So rather than counting a credible geography as one correspondence, it actually counts for several hundred. The probability of guessing reams of details all correctly is zero. Joseph Smith did not know about Central America before reading Incidents of Travel in Central America, and he did not know where Book of Mormon lands were. So the Book of Mormon geography correlation becomes compelling evidence that he did not write the book. I mentioned that the Book of Mormon's prediction of civilized peoples was verified in Joseph's lifetime. The book's civilization claim is actually twofold, because it describes an earlier Jaredite civilization that overlapped a few centuries with Lehite civilization. The dates for the Nephite half of Lehite civilization are clearly bracketed in the account to 587 years before Christ to 386 years after. But those for the earlier civilization remain cloudy, beginning sometime after the Tower of Babel and ending before King Mosiah fled to Zarahemla. Jaredites were probably tilling American soil in the land northward at least by 2200 BC, and they may have endured their own wickedness until 400 BC. The two civilizations requirement used to be a problem for the Book of Mormon, but it no longer is now that modern archaeology is catching up. As shown here, I am interpreting civilization in the strict sense as meaning city life. In checking correlations between the Book of Mormon and Mesoamerican archaeology, I focus on the rise and decline of cities. The earliest known Olmec city was up and running by 1300 BC, and it was preceded by a large community dating back to 1700 BC. Most Olmec cities were abandoned about 400 BC, probably under duress. In eastern Mesoamerica, Olmec civilization was replaced by the lowland Maya, who began building cities in the jungles of Guatemala about 500 to 400 BC. As with Olmec civilization, Maya civilization experienced peaks and troughs of development, with a mini-collapse about 200 AD. In short, the correspondences between the Book of Mormon and cycles of Mesoamerican civilization are striking. Reconstructing ancient demography requires detailed information on site sizes, locations, dates, and frequencies. It will take another 50 years to compile enough information to reconstruct Mesoamerica's complete demographic history. The Nephite and Lamanite stories are too complicated to review here. I will just consider the Jaredite period. As evident in this illustration, the earliest developments of the Jaredites and Olmecs are hazy, but from about 1500 BC onward, their histories are remarkably parallel. The alternations between city building and population declines described for the Jaredites correspond quite well with lowland Olmec developments. Olmec cities were abandoned by 400 BC, and the culture disappeared, just as the Book of Mormon describes for the Jaredites. This is a phenomenal correlation. Much more research in southern Mexico is needed to check the lands that Sorensen identifies as Nephite. The little I know of the region looks promising for future confirmations. Before leaving this issue, it is important to make one observation on a global question that troubles some saints. Could millions of people have lived in the area proposed as Book of Mormon lands? Yes, and they did. Mesoamerica is the only area in the Americas that sustained the high population densities mentioned in the Book of Mormon and for the time period specified. I will end the list of correspondences here. I have shown that the content of the Book of Mormon fits comfortably with Mesoamerican prehistory, both in general patterns and in some extraordinary details. Many things mentioned in the book still have not been verified archaeologically, but this was true just a few years ago for some items just reviewed. The trend over the last 50 years is one of convergence between the Book of Mormon and Mesoamerican archaeology. Book of Mormon claims remain unaltered since 1830, so all the accommodation has been on the archaeology side. If the book were fiction, this convergence would not be happening. We can expect more evidence in coming years. Getting back to the original question, did Joseph Smith write the Book of Mormon? He did not. It has been obvious since 1829 to those who knew him best that Joseph Smith could not have written the Book of Mormon. Recent findings simply make the impossibility of his authorship that much more impossible. The accumulating evidence from archaeology and the impressive internal evidence demonstrate that the Book of Mormon is an authentic ancient book of New World origin. The only plausible explanation for the book's existence is that supernatural agencies were involved in its coming forth in our day. The Book of Mormon still presses the world to take it seriously, and now science is lending a hand. The limited archaeology that has been undertaken in Mesoamerica is confirming historical, geographical, and political facts mentioned in the text. It is powerless, however, to address the book's central challenge, the promise that its doctrine leads to Christ. Although the Book of Mormon does not provide clear directions for reaching Zarahemla, its instructions for coming to Christ are unsurpassed, and this is the infinitely more important destination. If we are ever to reach this destination, we must keep the relationship between external Book of Mormon evidences and belief in proper perspective. President Hinckley sums up the matter better than I can, so I will conclude by reading his testimony. The evidence for the Book of Mormon's truth, for its validity in a world that is prone to demand evidence, lies not in archaeology or anthropology, though these may be helpful to some. It lies not in word research or historic analysis, though these may be confirmatory. The evidence for its truth and validity lies within the covers of the book itself. The test of its truth lies in reading it. It is a book of God. Reasonable people may sincerely question its origin, but those who have read it prayerfully have come to know by a power beyond their natural senses that it is true, that it contains the Word of God, that it outlines the saving truths of the everlasting gospel. Amen, and thank you.